Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi guys, welcome back to Almost Famous. This is part two with my own brother, Tobias Slater, where he'll explain all about when he experienced fame himself with his band Catch in the late 90s. Hope you're enjoying it. Cheers.
Moving on to your own experiences of fame, but you would say not fame, but you know, I'd slightly argue that being on Top of the Pop certainly gave you your 15 minutes. But moving on to your band and stuff, I'm really interested, not only because I don't know, but also because I think it's interesting for an audience to know how this stuff comes about. How did you go from being, you know, a kid who wrote songs and was interested in music to getting a record deal? What was the process, you know, in terms of getting your music into people's hands? How long did it take? What actually happened?
I won't lie, family connections do make a difference.
Okay.
They do play a part. So that's going to be part of the story. I had been messing around with songs the whole time. So when I was at school, I wrote a Christmas song, which is on this BBC thing called Song for Christmas, which Gary Barlow from Take That had won 1 year. So I was, you know, at the age of 12. And that actually may have played a part in my dislike of what was going on with Angus, our mum, as well, because I think I was conscious of wanting to do my own stuff creatively and not wanting to be muddled up in horrible, squabbly tabloid stuff. It's not to say that my music was in any way highbrow, because it wasn't. It was very, you know, very trite and silly. But
It seems like you were aware even at that age, though, that potentially, you know, it would be newsworthy if, say, you won that Song for Christmas competition. It would be newsworthy for a paper to put those things together.
I don't know if that's true, actually, because for some reason I did a bunch of weird things. I also, at some point, because I've always loved animation, did Rolf's Cartoon Club.
Oh, yeah, God.
And
oh my God, with Stephanie being on Jim'll Fix It and you being Rolf's Cartoon Club, we've really covered all those bases.
Yeah. Although I, you know, I think what we've learned over the past 10 years or so is that there's barely anyone in the UK media who wasn't touched by some of those characters,
whether touched by greatness
or in actuality. So yeah, I went on that, and it wasn't anything about fame. It was literally, I don't know how it happened, whether I wrote into them or what.
I remember us going to Bath or somewhere for that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was filmed. I think it was sort of a local
Bristol or Bath or something.
Thing in Bristol or Bath. Yeah, and so I don't know if I was that deliberately aware. I just know that I was creative. I liked doing things, and that was always my focus much more. And
do you think you wanted to be famous?
I think the video of Michael Jackson on the MTV show where he had a fan go through his Neverland ranch and everything was filmed in a sort of Vaseline smeared golden glow definitely had an impact on me. I don't know if you remember, we watched...
I remember we had two videos. We had the VHS of The Making of Thriller.
Yeah.
And we had Michael Jackson, The Story Continues, which was a kind of a biog of Michael Jackson, I guess, and included the very famous Motown 25 performance where he first did the moonwalk.
Yeah, and I seem to remember there being interviews with all sorts of celebrity people, and one of them being, I think Katharine Hepburn or someone like that, he said, you know, if you want to find the boy next door, don't go and look at Michael Jackson because he ain't the boy next door. So I grew up with that, you know, that era of pop music being really front and center. And our neighbors took me to see Michael Jackson on the Bad Tour at Milton Keynes Bowl, where it was approximately 2.5
not miles me.
To the stage. Yeah, you didn't go because, again, you were just rolling around in your Spurs kit blankly.
But to be fair, I mean, to be fair, Angus would take me to football and you weren't interested in football. So, you know, makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, although Angus liked football and music.
That's true. That's true.
He was a big fan of Genesis.
Yeah. Yeah,
he liked Genesis. He also quite liked Marillion. So I think that's a sort of prog rock thing going on. So anyways, so I got really into Michael Jackson, was, you know, went to that concert. And so that, you can't take that away. Like if you grow up in the 90s, 80s and 90s, and that is your idea of what pop music can be, it's hard to put that out of your head. That's not to say that that's in any way what I modeled myself on creatively, because I just didn't bother that much. You know, the truth is that the amount of work that he did to get there is absolutely incredible. And I wasn't that, but I did like creating. I would say that I like creating more for its own sake than as a, you know, than as a path to fame in its own right. You can't decouple them, but you know, I just enjoyed making things. So I was always making tapes, and that went on for ages. And then I started doing work experience at a company called Hall or Nothing, which managed artists, including the Manic Street Preachers, and also had its own PR department. And they did press for artists, including Radiohead.
And was that through our sister?
It was indeed. So that's the sort of, when I say family connections, that was the first one that, you know, I was 13 or 14.
Wow.
And I was cutting out newspapers where there'd been articles and gluing them onto sheets of paper and photocopying them. So, you know, if the band had a review or whatever, they would end up with a big binder full of their photocopied reviews that they could look at.
Right.
So I was doing that kind of thing in my summer holidays, and also writing and recording stuff. Eventually Martin Hall from that company said, you know, would you be interested in me recording some demos? And I did some demos with
so but presumably you'd already played him some of your stuff at this point, had you?
Yeah. And
that's brave. No, how do you have that bravery? I definitely wouldn't have that bravery.
I was very, I've already said earlier on, you know, that I was sort of hyperactive and a bit of an ass. And this period of my life, the sort of teens, I was doing a bunch of stuff that in my head was just about establishing myself as a human being in my own right, that was away from all this stuff happening both at home with Angus and our mum, and also in Surrey where we grew up, you know, and at the quite sort of closed-minded, limited, parochial environment that we were in. So I was going to London more. I was DJing and co-promoting and, you know, working to help put on a night at Madame Jojo's, which is a nightclub. And I was doing stuff in the summer festivals, working at the guest list boxes. And I was hanging out at a club called Smashing, where there were people like the performance artist Lee Bowery, and it was a very dressed up and queer environment with a host called Matthew Glamour, who was sort of almost like draggy performance artist kind of person. You know, I was also going to mod clubs wearing suits. So, you know, I was just trying to experiment creatively with who I was and meeting people. That was very much an adult world away from the sort of school and family life.
And you think you were what, like 14, 15 at this point? I remember bits of this, but again, not ever putting two and two together or asking, I guess, what was going on. I remember the suits. I remember Arcadia, which is where you were DJing. But the main memory I have is basically us dropping you off at Woking Station and my mum, I think, giving you a fiver to get the train, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I had, as I got a little older as well, I had a friend from school who was also in into sort of indie music. And we would go and see Pulp together, or we'd go and see American post-grunge bands. Sadly, he died of cancer just after I left school. But we would go to see concerts, and then the classic thing of like missing the 1:05 a.m. train back to Woking, and then either sitting on the platform, or, you know, once I remember having to get a cab back, and our mum was really furious. But sometimes from that with him, I'd end up, you know, backstage. So at one time we were at, you know, backstage, and there was Blur, and another time it was Elastica, you know, even in a pub in Windsor. So there were, you know, various kind of up and coming bands. And so that's how this idea of me meeting other people and saying, I'd like to form a band of my own. That's where that started. I'd been writing songs, but then there's sort of a nascent germ of an idea of maybe I've got a band. And I went to one of those business card printing machines that they used to have in the 90s.
Yeah, on Guildford Station platform, maybe.
On Guildford Station, yeah. And I put a quid in there and typed out that I was in this band called Brattish, B-R-A-T-T-I-S-H, that I didn't even come up with that name. I think someone else had said it. And there was some sort of slogan on it and my name. So I would give those out to people. And I think the idea of this cocky kid was intriguing to some people. And later on, there's a book called Kill Your Friends by Jonathan. And he refers to this era. I think he's referring it to, you know, there's all these, I think the bar was really low, basically, and that anyone who, you know, had a halfway decent look and a demo tape could sort of get signed. And
hold on, a bit of self-deprecation there, I think. I mean, all of firstly, everything you've described is so abnormal to me. I mean, to me, and I think to any normal person at that age who would just be like, you know, so afraid of showing their creativity to anyone, let alone, you know, because also I think it only matters in terms of giving the audience a visual. You know, you're a young looking 15-16, you weren't a big big adult like the kids were when I went to my second school, and you know, traipsing round southeast of England giving out business cards to people who were already in the business, it's not like anyone could do this. That this is like a proper balls out brave thing that I can't even imagine.
Sometimes as well, like I was really young looking. These days you would say I was misgendered frequently. So, you know, I looked very effeminate and very androgynous at best. I was frequently misgendered. And I also wore really gay clothes. So, you know, I remember once you and I were at a HMV or something, and I had a really tight t-shirt on, and some guys sort of shouted at me.
Yeah.
And I used to get that on Woking Station all the time, because I'd be wearing like a frock coat or something, some sort of antique 1900s Edwardian trousers, and people would frequently come and say stuff. I think the fact that I looked like a girl meant that it would be really stupid of them to actually punch me, because they'd look pathetic. Like, anyone can go and punch a small child that looks like a girl. So I think I got away with some of the more risque things. I remember being in the queue to a club once, and someone said, "What are you, the fucking Count de Monte Cristo?" Because I was there with like a furry cape on that I'd got from a, you know, charity shop in Woking.
Quite a good line. Do you know what? Now that you repeated it though, I've suddenly got that anxious feeling in my stomach, because I'd totally forgotten that story of the HMV. It was HMV on Oxford Street. I really remember it, and I got such an anxious feeling when that happened, that they were abusing you, and that neither of us could do anything about it. And I was afraid, but also like that feeling of don't say that to my brother.
I think these days, people who are creative in the same way would probably be doing it on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok, you know, and I think maybe there's a little bit of safety behind the screen, but they will still be receiving those comments from those same people. Yeah. You know, so occasionally when the nights are long and I'm feeling very masochistic, I'll go and look at some of the work that I've done on YouTube that people have uploaded, and all of the comments are just massively homophobic. And, you know, a lot of them are really funny, but you know, that person who just wants to shout at you because you look the wrong way, they're all over the internet. And I think that, you know, 14-year-olds these days will be creating their stuff, but they're on YouTube channels or they're on TikTok or whatever. There's actually a guy on Instagram who's got an account where he teaches people how to sell candy in their playground.
Right. That doesn't sound good.
So anyway, there are people out there now that they probably don't have to do quite as much kind of networking in real life. You can probably spend more of your time bonding by doing a video reply to someone else's, but it's the same process. Yeah. And actually the danger is, you know, that if you're big now on YouTube or TikTok, you can be in the media within days, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas that's that, yes, there were a few mentions of my made up band, for sure. But they were in, like, you know, obscure music magazines and not, you know, all over every website in the world.
Okay. And so how did we get from business card to record deal?
So again, like I said, we were in an era when if you had a halfway decent look and a song or two, you could get a record deal. And there are loads of examples of this because it was the tail end, as I was saying.
Menswear.
Yeah. So basically it was the tail end of the period where music was selling gangbusters. You know, CDs were huge and record labels were doing a thing where you could buy the single as a CD, but you could also buy it as a tape and as a vinyl and sometimes as two more CDs. So that was a way of getting it into the charts at a really high level. So sometimes if you're a fan, like I, you know, would buy not just one, but two CDs so you could get all the B-sides. And so, yeah, there were bands that were in the kind of Britpop vein. And the most notorious of these was Menswear, who I was fairly friendly with. In fact, I used to, during this era, sort of scout for their record label. You know, they were the epitome of a band that just looked great and had a couple of songs.
And the record label would pay you to do that, would they?
Well, actually, it was a bit of a scam. The guy was like, I want you to bring me recommended tracks and tapes and stuff, and then I will give you money, but you've got to deliver like receipts and taxis so I can put it through my expenses.
Right. Expenses scam.
Expenses scam, basically. and so, yeah, so Menswear were the most notorious, but there were loads of these bands that got signed, and there was this big kind of burst in the Britpop era of artists getting signed, some for huge amounts of money, because with Catch we got signed for £200,000, and it was the sense that, you know, records are huge. If you fail, that's okay, because there's another, you know, 900 bands just like this. And this was the era when, you know, 90% of music industry signings failed, but on the 10% they could do really well. So I was recording loads of stuff. We developed a band. Martin Hall from Hall or Nothing was paying for us to rehearse in a really stinky, sweaty, smoke-filled, because it was when people did still smoke indoors, studio in Forest Acton. And he kept on saying, you know, this song isn't good enough, this song isn't good enough. And we never got to the point where he thought any of the songs were good enough. But eventually our sister agreed to pass on, Tracy agreed to pass on one of my tapes to Stannard and Rowe, who are the producers of
Spice Girls,
Wannabe by the Spice Girls, which her husband, Mark, had mixed. And so bear in mind, our management had repeatedly said, you don't have any songs that are good enough, you need to keep going. So I kept going. And they, the producers of the Spice Girls, latched onto this one song called Bingo, and they thought it was brilliant. So we still didn't have any songs that our management thought were good. But now we had some champions in the shape of these number one worldwide smash producers. So they then played it to someone at London Records who had All Saints and had a long, you know, quite...
big roster.
You know, it's quite huge reputation. Yeah. And they also played it to someone at Virgin Records who had the Spice Girls. So we had instant interest, And I think Martin Hall, with his reputation with the Manic Street Preachers, was able to sort of create a bit of a bidding war situation. And this, again, bear in mind, he didn't think we had the song still, and we hadn't done touring. We hadn't really worked out what our sound was specifically. We just knew that, you know, I knew that I wanted to be a kind of hybrid of pop bands, whether it's sort of like 80s pop bands like ABC or current day, you know, boy bands, sort of melded with Britpop music, the, you know, like Pulp.
And what made you, I think it's really interesting, because I have a memory of being that, being described to me as what you were going for. But I also think you, in terms of your talent as a songwriter, are quite a more of like a piano-based, almost more of like a melancholic Jeff Buckley, Tom Yorke-y, I don't know how you'd describe it, but piano-based ballad writer in general.
Maudlin, sort of morbid.
Well, basically, all the music I love, to be honest, the kind of music that I love, and there's definitely a huge audience for. So I'm kind of intrigued as to what made you want to go down the pop route.
I think the songs that I was writing earlier generally were a bit more quirky and Britpoppy, but I've always had this huge range of stuff that I listen to. So yes, I absolutely love Joni Mitchell. I think she is probably the finest songwriter, you know, or in sort of singer-songwriter area, and her stuff kind of, you know, I find my music sounding like her stuff occasionally when I'm writing. And I think also the medium that you use to write or to record makes a big difference. So if I'm playing on a piano, it will sound very like a kind of moribund white boy Radiohead style ballad. But when you take a band to it, you start doing it at a different tempo, it will start sounding different. And I think a lot of the other material that I did was more quirky. And I knew that, you know, this was before Jeff Buckley had become like a legendary thing. This was before people had rediscovered Nick Drake through TV adverts. And I think it was more an era of a really vast amount of quite dire pop music. And I had a sense that that's what needed to be done. I think there's almost a sense that, like, of a, you know, they talk about the kind of difficult second album or sophomore slump. There's almost a sense that you have to do some more mainstream material before you are permitted by record labels to do stuff which was more introspective.
Got it.
So I think I was playing that game a bit. But also that's, you know, that's what I was influenced by. You know, I did love Pulp and Alaska and a lot of those Britpop artists, because that was the music right at the cusp of my teenagedom, having grown up on Michael Jackson and all of the sort of classics and, you know, Beatles and David Bowie and all that stuff that was around growing up, and all the 80s stuff, Duran Duran and Ultravox even, that we talked about, Go West, you know, pivoting into the stuff which I was exposed to during my childhood. So that came out, you know, that sort of Brit poppiness. And then there's just a cynical thing, which is like, this is an idea. And then later on, some other bands went on to do that idea. So after Catch, there was a band called the Dum Dums. And then after them, there was Busted, who I think got there closest. But we were amongst the first trying to do it, this sort of hybrid of guitar band and pop band. And so actually just the middle bridging bit is that Martin Hall also, you know, he was a big part of it, because he, you know, he had sort of nurtured my creativity throughout those periods between when I was doing the working at, you know,
cutting stuff out,
sticking things together. Yeah. So props to him as well. And then I did my A levels, and age 17, straight after finishing my A levels, just left home, and within a few weeks had found a little bed sit and went on the dole and had housing benefit back when it was easy to do that, and just started networking like crazy and going out and recording lots and, you know, really focusing hard. That was, you know, that was another ingredient, really. I'm jumping about time wise, but I think that aspect is so hard these days to do that bit, which was really key, which was having some time when I, you know, I knew that my rent was paid for because I was on the dole and on housing benefit and I wasn't being pushed, you know. And actually, maybe that's something that I feel has come back again in this brief period because of Corona times, that thousands and thousands of people, whether they're creative or not, have just been told by the government, here's universal credit. Here's universal credit. We're giving you this money. We're not going to question it too hard. We're not going to check. You don't have to come into the center, all of that stuff. And while it's been a horrendously, you know, disempowering time for so many people, I do wish that there were things like universal basic income that would just allow people to have that breathing space to do their thing for a little while, without having to turn up at a job center every couple of weeks and beg and go and get a, you know, a minimum wage or a sort of 0 hours job.
Yeah. I think the flip side of that is a lot of people would say, you know, if you want to be creative, get yourself a job and do it in your own time. But I, you know, I completely agree with you. And I think you should be, you know, I think there should be ways in which you can chase your creativity and find a way to do it that way, but it's not always as simple as that.
I'm saying that I wouldn't have got to the next stage very easily without having that breathing space. And we're not talking about vast amounts of money. I didn't live in luxury or anything like that. You know, it wasn't you know, I was living in a weird building with, you know, maybe 30 families.
I remember it being slightly like a crack den.
Yeah, the guy who lived next door to me was a heroin addict, like an active using heroin addict who would borrow tinfoil from me regularly. And there we had
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Several bed bugs outbreaks, and you know, it was a strange place, but it allowed me to just sit and do that thing, and I think just trying to connect to our present days, you know, I hope that there are other people right now who are able to just about pay the rent and just about eat, because I know things are hard, but maybe, you know, do a thing which they want to do. Because I think lately the music industry and creativity has got so focused on, you've got to, whoever you are, you've got to create something that's incredibly commercial and absolutely laser precision focused on making hits, and you've got to collaborate with three other artists and have 19 songwriters on your track, you know?
Yeah.
It's a big ask these days.
It is. And so I'm intrigued to know, in terms of then, you know, you talked about the bidding war, and then in terms of the feeling when you actually presumably at some point go into an office with a record label and sign that deal, which I guess must be like the, you know, the goal really for all those years before. Like, how did that feel, and what was it like?
Yeah, although when you say all those years before, you know, I have to be honest, it still was a bit like walking blindly, naively into this thing, feeling like, you know, I somehow deserved it. But in reality, it was all a matter of, you know, happenstance and family connections and the fact that the industry was at this very fervent time of kind of hot, you know, desire to find the next thing. So, you know, it felt to me at the time like, oh, this is perfectly natural. We're going to get the record deal and then we're going to make an album and, you know, it'll be successful and then we'll go on to the next achievement. Because it, you know, it was just a classic sort of deluded assumptions that had been reinforced by not only what I'd seen in family, but also, like I said, what was in the media and that sort of, I think, mythology around sort of pop stardom that I think was around a lot. One thing I want to point out, though, is that the record company check was regular sized. It was not a giant check. And also
that's ruined my vision.
I just remembered as well another story, which is that our dad, I think he signed a band called the Inspiral Carpets. Do you remember them?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And their logo, they were like a sort of Manchester band, and their logo was a cow, like an illustrated cow. He kept on talking. I remember sometime we saw him, and he wanted to get a cow and paint a check onto it so that the cow became a giant check. And he wanted to hand
That does sound like a good idea.
He wanted to hand over the giant check. Here you are. And I imagine like him trying to herd the cow. I mean, and then I imagine Peter coming through and being like, this is cruelty. Anyway. So it all felt natural, but how did it feel? It just felt like how it should be, but that's really just where the hard work starts, you know? And that's also where all the sort of problems start. Because I think in that era when people were signing artists with no proof or evidence that they were actually capable, things got really out of hand. I don't think things are like that anymore, to be honest. But I think there was, do you know what? I was listening to this thing as a podcast that some guys made. Some people like sent me this thing, you need to listen to this. And it's like these like metal fans reviewing a bunch of records. And then for some reason they review the Catch record and they tell this anecdote about how apparently we burnt through like £1 million of Virgin's money. Now, I don't know how much because they don't easily show you that. And also the marketing money, which is, you know, the stuff that's spent on videos and photos, that side was not something we had to pay for. But what we would have to pay for is all the recording stuff of the records and the orchestra that we had on one of the track and all of that. And I know that we did spend a lot of money, but I don't know if it's £1 million. And I also don't know where they heard that it was £1 million. But it was clearly enough for some random people who are in the music industry to hear about it. So I guess even before we'd released anything, we were probably already getting a bad reputation in the music industry. But also, that was the podcast that said that we recorded the worst song ever made.
And how did it feel watching that?
This was only a couple of months ago, I think like last year. I was tickled pink. Like, I couldn't believe that anyone remembered the track or that they would sit down and like talk about it for, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. And they said that one of them said that it kind of, the song Bingo made them feel sort of icky and uncomfortable. And not everything that they said about the track was stuff that I think was completely true and accurate and fair, and I would probably agree with. And it's kind of a weird honor, you know, to make people feel anything, I think.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I mean, you know, all attention is good attention to some degree, but if it's good to, you know, I guess, you know, your skin is thick enough to deal with that now, although admittedly it was, what, we're talking, you know, 23 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, so yeah, there's a load of time.
I mean, test of time.
I think it helps that song and some others of the songs that I did and that we did, you know, it is a naturally playful song and it was deliberately camp, and I am massively into camp. So, you know, I think that helps as well. You know, it's not like if it, there are lots of other songs that I've done which are a lot more serious, and if people were saying those ones were the worst songs ever made, I think then I'd maybe be a bit more hurt.
So you mentioned that then the problems started. I mean, without going into it in, you know, all the depth that we could, I'm sure, what, you know, why didn't it work out? Like, you got to, I think Bingo got to number, was it 23? You're on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Obviously, like I said,
you scraped into Top of the Pops.
Scraped into Top of the Pops, but then, you know, you had a lot of press, actually, to be fair. And then also, like I said in the intro, you were quite successful in Thailand and Indonesia. But in general, looking back on it, you know, why do you think it didn't reach the level of success that you wanted?
So I guess I guess there's two major ingredients when it comes to a pop hit. One is, you know, the record and the band and the whole kind of confection of you as an artist and as a band. And then the other bit is the music business and the record company and the politics of it. So those bits have all got to be right, you know, like, so all of the creative bits of the music and the artistry and the image have got to be right. And also it's got to be the right time for it. And the record company have got to be behind it. Now, we had all of those bits in play for the first record, but when Bingo didn't hit as huge as they'd hoped, despite us having the two CDs with the four different B-sides, I think that, you know, the record company had the wind out of its sails a bit, and then, you know, we had like the people who are our champions at the record label moved on, and it was a lot harder, and we were just literally left our own devices. We just then recorded an album with the producers didn't turn up a lot of the time. The record company never listened to it, as far as I was aware, really. We had, you know, we just sort of passed through different iterations of record company.
Is this a bit like a kind of tale as old as time, what people say when it doesn't work out, though? Because, like, I I've heard a lot of musicians talk about, oh, you know, when they've had those opportunities, oh, their A&R men moved on, or these little things. You know, do you genuinely feel that's it, or are there things, mistakes you feel you made, for instance, as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not, like, we could talk for hours about the mistakes that I've made. So that's, like I said, they're the both parts of it, right? So if we'd made a consistent, coherent album where all of my songs, bear in mind, I said that our manager said that we didn't have enough good songs, right? And I think that was probably still the case, but definitely what was a problem is that we didn't have like a coherent, consistent bunch of songs that all fit together. And I was, you know, just having fun, like in the studio. We worked with a bunch of different people, so we end up with a bunch of different tracks which sounded different, and on some of them it was a kind of huge orchestral thing, some others had more electronic instrumentation, you know, and they were recorded at a bunch of different times. So that part of it, which was our responsibility, was all over the place. And then the image didn't quite sort of hit home, you know, although we had a Dazed and Confused cover shot by Rankin, and although we were in both the kind of newspapers like The Times, and we were also in Melody Maker, and we were also in Smash Hits, which was sort of the dream. I don't think the public really liked it that much. And I think arguably we were neither the kind of, we were at the sort of arse end of boy band. We were on the same label as 911.
Yeah. 911.
It turned out to be an uncomfortable name. And
best press they got.
We, Yeah, and we were also not a cool artist, like, you know, not even a sort of kitschy cool artist like Pulp. So we were sort of neither of those things. We definitely had our fans, but I think generally people were probably just like, what the fuck?
Slightly fell between two stools.
We fell between two stools, and I think then, because we didn't have a sort of consistent, coherent album, we definitely had songs that I really like and that people really like, but I think, you know, in the absence of that, people just didn't know what to do with us. And yeah, and I think you do need a champion at record label who's going to say, I'm responsible for this, I'm going to listen to all their music, I'm going to, you know, put them together with this producer or whatever. But we weren't, the other thing is, you know, this was an era of manufactured bands, and I remember there being some review that said we were a manufactured band. Partially that was the problem. We weren't a manufactured band, we were self-manufactured. And I think if, you know, there had been a lot of direction or sort of cynical planning, things might be different. But actually Virgin gave us quite a lot of creative freedom. And, you know, we did put a fair few bits of our own thinking into things.
I spoke to Chesney Hawkes on this podcast, and he talked about how when he was dropped by his record label, they didn't even tell him and they weren't answering his calls. Did you know, is that a reality?
Oh, yeah. No, that sounds very familiar. I don't think you get told directly, like a meeting where someone says, we're about to drop you. It's very much more like you're ghosted. So it's kind of more like, you know, these days you'd probably be told in a WhatsApp thread, I would guess. And then I remember being like pretty gutted, because the record company's meant to be like storing all your stuff sort of securely, and so that you can kind of, you know, access those tracks or any of the merchandise you had or the props you'd had or whatever. I think Martin and our lawyer negotiated for us to get the rights to all that stuff back, the thinking being that we could then sort of sign to another label. But they'd lost a lot of it as well, which made me sort of think like, oh, we've moved offices, but we don't really care about this band, so who knows where their stuff goes, we'll just throw it out. I think there is that sense of, it's easy to blow up and for people to think that like the career of an artist or a band is more important than it is. I think it only starts to count once you are actually successful, you know. Things might have changed now because this was a long time ago. But yeah, Chesney Hawkes had a huge, huge number one. He was the one and only.
Yeah, he still is the one and only. When eventually the ghosting came to fruition and you knew you were dropped, how did that affect you and your mental health, and how did you bounce back?
I don't know if I ever did bounce back, to be honest. I think I think, bear in mind that, you know, there were two other guys in Catch, and I think they both, Ben and Wayne, had been sort of pulling in other directions and wanted to do other sorts of music, and I had been writing a load of other stuff that didn't really fit in with Catch anyway. So I think all of us were sort of trying to do something different, and I had been spending a lot of time in America and starting to sort of play acoustic stuff in coffee shops over there, and it was the beginning of the kind of MP3 revolution where Napster was beginning to happen, and there was just this sense that the internet was going to be a thing, and I wanted to be part of that. So I don't know if I ever sort of bounced back, because I wasn't really sure that I wanted to do a big major record label thing again.
Did you have opportunities to go elsewhere? Was that a thing?
I think to do that, it's almost like a kind of war campaign. You know, you just kind of have to put, you know, you'd have to kind of assemble your troops and go back in there again. But certainly I recorded stuff that was paid for by a number of other labels and worked with a bunch of other songwriters over the years, you know, many of whom were, you know, either very successful then or have gone on to become very successful now. So I certainly had a lot of skirmishes with stuff that was sort of paid for by record labels. And I had an indie single that was paid for by a, you know, by a small indie label, and also had stuff, you know, that was funded by other interesting places, like Napster promoted a thing that ended up being downloaded hundreds of thousands of times from their service. And I put out a video that, even before YouTube, was downloaded all over the internet and streamed, you know, in, even before YouTube existed. And now someone else has put on YouTube. So there's sort of all sorts of creative and weird stuff going. But I knew that I didn't really want to do the traditional major label pop band thing again. And I wanted to see what was going to happen, like whether that journey was something that you had to do or whether there would be other routes to distribute music.
Right. And then, and so looking back on those times, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and not having kind of gone back into music and now being more in the event space, do you think you should have tried, gone a different way, tried again? Is it something you wish you'd done in a different way? Do you wish you were making a career out of music now? How does that all come together?
I feel like I was lucky to sort of be making music at a time when Top of the Pops existed, you know, and that you could do, as we did, you know, you could put out a track and be all over music TV, because again, that was really huge, you know, at the time. And now is a very different era, and I was just on that cusp. And I think in order to have been, to continue at the sort of level of pop success that I was aiming for then, would probably have involved doing things like, you know, Big Brother, or, you know, having to become more of a celebrity for its own sake.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really dealing with I wasn't the kind of cool artist who was, you know, had credibility. I don't think that's going to come back very easily. You know, it's quite hard to, when you've done something that is deliberately, knowingly out and out cheesy, it's quite hard to kind of say, actually, I'm a cool, credible artist.
See, I think that's quite a shame, because I actually think your best music is really cool and credible.
But I just enjoy making music. And so, yeah, some of the catch stuff that's the best stuff, you know, which is quite typical for bands, are our B-sides. And there are even some people online who've kind of made blogs where they've sort of pieced together all the tracks that we had, and they've put together like their favorite compilations. And some of those tracks are B-side tracks. And I just like making music for its own sake. So I think tangling with some of the more out and out pop stuff that was going on and the kind of celebrity making was probably not for me. But
probably because of what you experienced as a kid, I would have thought.
Yeah, maybe. But I think a lot of musicians would say the same thing, right? That they want, a lot of people will say, and it's a bit of a cliche, you know, that they're happy for fame to come as a byproduct of their creativity. And it's a bit of a cliche, because, and it's not entirely true, because I think there's a mix of motivations. But I think I'm still very much in that camp where I really love it when someone talks about having enjoyed my music or remembering a particular track or whatever. That there is fulfillment in there, and I'm definitely still up for that. But when I was invited to do Nevermind the Buzzcocks in the round where
The lineup,
they stand people up, the lineup, you know, I definitely was like, no, thank you.
And our mum has been invited on that as well, I believe.
Why didn't she agree to do that?
I don't know. I think they only offer a few hundred quid, don't they? Well, they did.
I think they do. I think, I mean, if they gave, you know, exactly, some sort of incentive, which was a bit more exciting.
So I want to just, it's been an amazing chat, really fascinating to me. I hope for the audience as well, in terms of giving an insight, certainly into growing up around Vane, but also
another failed musician.
But also an insight into, you know, I mean, this podcast isn't about the literal meaning of Almost Famous, but in terms of getting that record deal and the push and how close that, you know, I guess it works on a literal level as well. I just wanted to ask then, in terms of how close you got and stuff, you know, could you pinpoint any any regrets, like proper big regrets that you think could have changed things and meant that now, instead of where you are, and I'm not suggesting you're unhappy with where you are, but instead you would be a, you know, successful, probably credible singer-songwriter who had a pop past, you know, what George Michael became, for instance, after Wham.
Oh my God. George Michael, you mean who died ignominiously and had a very depressed end of his life.
Had an amazing career, had started in a pop band and became an incredibly successful, yeah, you know, artist, famous artist for his songwriting genius.
I love George Michael, and also Wham were huge, and he wrote Careless Whisper when he was like 12 or something. I think I just feels incredible to mention anything on that scale. I think I would then and now be happy with making music that, you know, gets heard. I think you know, we would talk a good talk and say we'd like to make an album which is as big as The Lexicon of Love by ABC, or, you know, like a huge successful album. I think in reality, you know, making a career that continues where you're able to produce music that people hear and that impacts people, that is what most songwriters want, and that's what I wanted at the time. And yes, that would still be really appealing, you know, if there was a way of doing that. I think the problem is that there's so much, so many barriers in front of people just listening to a song, and there are also so many songs out there that often in the music business it feels like when someone's listening to your song, they're just not listening to it in its own right. And sometimes the very things, like I remember I wrote this, co-wrote this song with an American songwriter, and it had this line in it about seeing someone standing at a Chinese barbecue, and the record company person came back and said, well, of course that'll never be a hit because it's got that line in it. And I just sort of felt like so many songs that I love have bizarre lyrics in them. And that's a constant battle that I wasn't really, that's the part of it that I didn't enjoy, is sort of non-constructive criticism.
Ironically, the part that our father was probably having to do for his job for many years.
Yeah, that's true, actually, because he worked as an A&R person for a record company, and he probably said stupid things to people all the time. But, you know, so it's, I would have liked to continue working and making music. But you also have to get to a point where you're settled and successful enough that people are engaging with you creatively and listening to your stuff and offering new suggestions. And that, you know, that is quite a privileged position to get to that part. And I think a lot of that now is probably even harder. Like I said, you know, there's probably a lot of pressure on artists now to be working with really top producers and songwriters and creating these laser focused tracks, because again, there's unlimited stuff on SoundCloud and YouTube and Spotify that you can listen to if you want, but to get above that noise is really hard. So I don't know if I have that many regrets, because I still am creative, and that's what I really love doing in different ways, and I still write songs and I still record songs occasionally.
From my point of view, like, I've, you know, if I'm going to be totally honest about it, it's like I've always been envious of the fact that you have, you know, and this isn't just me being biased. I'm a music fan as well. I mean, it's probably hard to see through the bias, I suppose, or for other people to look and see through the bias. But I think you have an undoubted talent that I've always been incredibly envious of, that you had this thing when you were that you knew from very young that you wanted to do. And then you had all the kind of, the journey, the positive feedback, the reality that it's so close to getting to where you wanted it to be, or to the career that you wanted to have. And a little bit, I guess, it frustrates me that you're not doing that anymore, because it's such a kind of you're so good at it, in my opinion, that you should be just, you know, if possible, just doing it, still getting it out there, putting it into people's hands in the way you were right at the start, because I'm so sure you're, you know, even if at this point it's just, I say just, but writing for other people, it's...
Yeah, I mean, I have over the years continued to co-write with people and continue to occasionally perform, and I still love doing that. I think it just also comes up against capitalism. Like I was saying earlier on about the, you know, the universal credit thing. It's like, if someone can devote themselves wholeheartedly without having to worry about how to pay the rent or pay for their food, then yes, I would definitely be doing that. But it is, you know, it is a really hard journey. And so anyone who does succeed, no matter how crap or cheesy their music might be, you know, they have probably had to work a fair bit under today's environment. Comparatively, though, when I was, you know, in the late 90s walking into Catch, you know, we really did get a lot of it handed on our plate, and it didn't take that same degree of effort. Does that make sense?
It does, like, but I'd argue that, you know, what you don't look back on as effort in terms of spending 3, 4, 5 years going into London every night, you know, having your balls out saying, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that, that is more effort than most people have put in their lives in terms of self-promotion, which I find very, very difficult.
You know, what I would give as a comparison is, which I find really inspiring, is Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton.
Yeah.
He publishes on his Twitter account his rejection notes. And before he wrote Hamilton, he wrote this musical called In the Heights. And he applied to various funds and grants and bodies, some of whom were like, you know, the leading things in musical theatre, or they were founded by people he was really inspired by. And he's just got several rejection letters for a work which is now a Disney movie, you know, that has been made, you know, In the Heights has been, I think it's Disney, or it's a Hollywood movie anyway. And it's very much the same style, a similar sort of style as Hamilton. The actual work itself is really good, and yet it was getting rejected left, right, and center. And he did have to keep pushing. And then he also did, you know, a bunch of other stuff that you can really hear how good it is. And it's a reminder that you sort of think that people come fully formed, but they're having to continue working. And he was doing, you know, a day job at the same time as that. It's, you know, it's a lot. If anyone is offering to, you know, to sort of payroll me through and also do that other bit, the kind of helping shape something to actually get it into a shape where it's, you know, it's listenable as well, because I'm not a music producer. That's another aspect as well that I think, you know, in addition to that, you can listen to the Hamilton demos, right? And they're very, very different to the finished process. It's a whole other bit of work that needs to go in. So I would love to be doing all of that stuff. I don't know necessarily whether I would want to ever do it in exchange for, because I like doing all of the various creative projects that I do.
Sure. It's been an amazing chat. Once again, I want to give you an opportunity to plug your stuff. Is there anywhere, would you be interested in the audience going somewhere to try and hear some of your music? And if so, which songs, which tracks, where would they go? Which tracks would you recommend? And then also, obviously, the events that you're doing.
And I guess you can link to this, can't you, on your social?
I can put it in my social, and I can put it at the bottom in the description box.
So I've got some stuff that I've just put up for free of my music on SoundCloud. So if you looked, Tobias Fauntleroy Slater, Fauntleroy is not my real name. It's just good for search engine optimization.
okay, so Tobias Fauntleroy Slater on SoundCloud, great.
I've got a load of stuff there. And also, if you want to listen to Catch stuff, people have uploaded all sorts of videos and audio on YouTube. And I think you can sort of search or go to Wikipedia and people link to it.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the events that I do, if you look up the summerhouseweekend.com/events or just find out a little bit more about us, follow us there.
Okay, brilliant. I've really enjoyed the chat. Guys, at home, thank you so much for listening. Please do press that subscribe button on Almost Famous, rate the podcast, and leave us a comment too. Find us on Instagram at Almost Famous the Podcast and on Twitter at Pod Almost Famous. I'll make sure to put some of my brother's links on there. Hope you enjoyed the chat, and thanks again for listening. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.